then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's October the 10th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, I asked for MP3 files from you guys, and this comrade complied. I have no idea who this is, but he uses the name Aristotle Darwin.
Why do we bother trying, even pretending, to look for a solution? Why, day after day, week after week, month after month, we continue to do the same thing as the cancer grows and grows until one day, as we continue to do nothing, the cancer destroys us. We waste days and days, years and years, with the same pathetic, vile, disgusting action, which is absolutely nothing. The only way we will ever overcome this patheticness is if we first look within ourselves to the solution of the problem. We must cast away the rot within ourselves, the degeneracy, the laziness, the weakness. We must cast it away, and we must become strong. We must become the pillars which other people, weaker people, look up to. They must look to us for guidance. They must look at the weak, the degenerate, the once leaders of our society, now nothing more than pathetic, corrupt politicians, no more legitimate than the Shah of Iran was. These people are controlled 100% by their Zionist masters. Yet we still vote in their pathetic system time after time. We pretend like it's going to make a difference time after time. When will you say enough? When will you finally have enough of these corrupt individuals? When will you look within yourself and try to solve this problem? To solve this problem, you must build yourself into a better character. You must become stronger, intellectually, physically, and health-wise. This entails reading every day. This entails working out every day. This entails trying to reach other people for the betterment of yourself and themselves. Every day, when people ask you on your views of society, on your views of politics, tell the truth and do not lie, for lying is what the corrupt politicians do. They must see truth within you, and they must accept it.
Finally, after a long, wild, and woolly series of breathtaking adventures I won't get into, Freedom's Sons is at long last published in proper hold-in-the-hand book form. and that's both paperback and hardback. I have placed a big bulk order, and when I receive that large bulk shipment of books, anyone who was in any way involved in the proofreading or production of Freedom Sons down through the years will receive a signed copy, either paperback or hardback. However, given the glacial slowness of the publishing company direct ordering process, it will probably be some weeks before you guys can receive those copies. Now, for those of you who just plain cannot wait, the novel is now available on Amazon.com, and I've placed a link on the Thought Crime blog at downwithjugears.blogspot.com. That's downwithjugears, all one word, .blogspot.com. As you can probably tell, this blog of mine was set up many years ago when Jug Ears Bush was president. For those of you who are either very new to the NF in this program or else who have been living in a cave on Mars for the past 3 years, Freedom's Sons is the fifth and last in my series of Northwest Independence novels. In the first four novels, that is to say A Distant Thunder, A Mighty Fortress, The Hill of the Ravens, and The Brigade, I followed the path of the Northwest War of Independence, which in my fictional depiction took 5 years of armed struggle. Which, my guess is, will prove to be about right whenever we decide that we really do want to be free and act accordingly. Unless the dictatorship is extremely weakened by the many years of monkey shines they've been cutting, I can't see their accountants surrendering in less than about 5 years of direct action and the extreme financial loss that would incur. And it will take the wealthy elite in D.C. and New York and the Hamptons probably about that long to recognize the fact that their wealth and their power are genuinely under threat. On the other hand, I honestly can't see the American dictatorship having the stamina to keep on slugging it out for 30 years like the British did with the IRA. If nothing else, once direct action begins in the Northwest, as it most assuredly will in one form or another, if the movement can just stay alive and keep functioning for the first couple of years, the short American attention span will kick in and they'll just get bored with it. Once they lose the media due to the introduction of the principle of personal responsibility for their behavior, the regime won't be able to sustain any public support for retaining the Northwest, and that's assuming that there's any American public left as we understand the term, which is by no means certain the way these people are going. Anyway, that's for the future when you guys decide that you actually want this. The fifth and last Northwest novel, Freedom Sons, addresses the first 50 years of the existence of the Northwest American Republic and all of the problems which would be involved in actually establishing a new nation on the face of the earth, everything from manufacturing and infrastructure to the economy and a new currency to culture and communications to security and fighting off sanctions and the threat of an American reinvasion. Now, you guys always claim that I'm never specific enough, and I never micromanage you enough. Okay, in Freedom Sons, I hold your hands and I walk you through it. No one in the movement has ever actually thought this far ahead before, or thought this deeply about exactly what it is we want. The white nationalist movement for the past 60 years basically has spent our time swilling beer and screaming white power, or else trying out various scams to get at old people's savings. And above all, we tap, 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 tap on our computer keyboards to the point where there is virtually no physical movement involving real people that exists anywhere in this country outside the internet, except for our little group here in the Northwest, of course. I have said before that in order to put together a jigsaw puzzle, the first thing you need is the cover of the box the pieces came in, so that you know what the final picture is supposed to look like and what you're trying to create. This last novel of mine shows you the final glimpse you get of the cover of the puzzle box. Freedom's Sons shows you what the prize itself looks like, or at least as much of it as I can show you in 1,000 pages. Now, this is the best fictional approximation I can come up with of what we will face when we finally establish the Northwest American Republic as an independent nation. I can't say exactly how that's going to go, of course, since I don't know what the exact circumstances of the Republic's birth will be. But certain difficulties and issues, I think, are a pretty safe bet to predict. Freedom's Sons chronicles the first 50 years of the NAR's existence as a country and a new society, including the struggle against crushing economic sanctions imposed by the outside world, as well as an attempt by the Americans to reconquer the Northwest with a military invasion. Now, that one is for all you people who have been whining for years that, oh no, our old government would never let us have our own country. And if we ever did, they'd just nuke us. They'd nuke us, Harold. Oh, it's so horrible. Anyway, the novel follows the lives and fortunes of three families, one of former rebels from the Northwest Volunteer Army, one Unionist, and one refugee family who flees to the Republic from the collapsing USA. Now, I know I've already posted certain chapters from Freedom Sons on the Thought Crime blog and elsewhere, and there was a Volume 1 and a typescript galley of the complete story that I did on Lulu.com, and those are still available, but this is finally it, the for-real book. The actual link is too long for me to read out, but just go to Amazon.com and do a search on Freedom's Sons by H.A. Covington, or else go to the Thought Crime blog and follow the link that I put up there on October the 8th. Now, a warning to those of you who have difficulty with long blocks of text, which unfortunately is a lot of people these days. This is a big, thick book, the longest I've ever written or ever will write. The official page number is 912 pages, but including the opening glossary, which is numbered in those little Roman numerals, the actual page total for the whole novel is 979 pages. Freedom's Sons is 364,000 words, which is pretty long, but then Atlas Shrugged is longer, and so is War and Peace. Actually, I was Googling the world's longest novels to see how Freedom's Sons shaped up, and it turns out it's not really so long after all compared to some. But 1,000 pages of text is still a lot for some young white boy who grew up on South Park and Family Guy, and who graduated from high school as a functional illiterate. Anyway, after 3 long years, it's done. Now here's Andy.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. I'm getting back on my white character recovery process today after going on a slight tangent last week. I didn't particularly care for going on that tangent, but world political events caught up with us and needed to be discussed. Also, the Step 2 material was shaping up to be quite long, and really that shouldn't be the case. Step 2 isn't a whole lot of fun, but it can be done pretty quickly, both in my presentation and your execution. As I said before, the white character recovery process, and more specifically Step 2, is a summary of all the white character material the party has presented in the past, but in a much shorter, punchier, and digestible form. Step 2 is to decide what about yourself needs to change in order for you to meet your immediate goal of Northwest Homecoming. In keeping with the microcosm analogy I've chosen, the party's Step 2 is to assess what we need to have in place and what we need to be capable of in order to bring the Northwest American Republic into existence. To put this formally, it's when a person decides to examine just how far they have to go and how hard they have to work in order to reach their goal. To put it metaphorically, Northwest migration is a mountain which you've decided to climb, and Step 2 is taking your first look up that mountain so that you're no longer kidding yourself about what you committed to doing. This step is perhaps the hardest because it requires a person to submit themselves to any and all criticism they can generate about themselves, and it requires this to be done in the most honest way possible. I didn't get many rave reviews of my prior Radio Free Northwest appearance because I had to say things about the way white nationalists do their politics which were downright insulting. For the record, I stand by all of it since it is all true. I don't normally go into such vivid detail when I'm trying to get a point across, but that's because quite a few of the points I convey on RFN aren't so nice. As I said last time, it is for the best if you all learn to properly self-criticize. If nothing else, this will serve as proper training to execute White Character Step 2. Last time on RFN, I was responding to criticism that I don't always make myself as understandable as I could. That's true, but no one can ever be as blunt as they want to, or else they'll piss everyone off. If you don't like it when I'm so blunt, perhaps you should actually try to understand me instead of putting me in a position where I feel like I have to talk down to you just to drag you a little bit further towards concluding you have to participate in the Northwest Imperative just like everyone else does, even if you don't want to. Radio Free Northwest, when discussing the issue of white character, has repeatedly brought up this refusal to understand, and that's not a cryptic term. It means we're saying things to you that you don't want to accept, so you act as if you never heard them. Sometimes this goes so far that someone will complain the party isn't doing enough or isn't helping them understand or isn't providing detailed directions for what we want you to do. Right after I made the decision to support the Butler Plan and came up with my own character correction initiatives, I made the decision to learn everything I could about the political, strategic, and other related concepts required to bring our new country into existence. I did this under my own steam, and you're expected to do the same. If you're cross that we haven't told you what to do, it's because you haven't been listening. But why wouldn't a person listen to what the party has to say, since it's so critically important you all find the motivation you need to comprehend us and come help us? It's because you don't want to. One of the things I was coming to accept right when I found the Northwest Front over 3 years ago is that the old ways are gone. America, at least the sort of America you learned about in school, is gone, and it's not coming back. No amount of whining to politicians, Rush Limbaugh, or other white nationalists is going to change that. The old white nationalist movement ways are gone, and nothing you or anyone else does is going to bring back your preferred organization, leader, or activity. There's no going back to those things, no matter how badly you want them. The demographic trends are too progressed, and the white nationalist movement has let far too much time pass for us to have any hope of reversing anything. Here was the real kicker for me. I had to realize my old life was gone. If I were to have my way, my life would be very different. But don't mistake me for whining. Far from it. The life I'm leading today is the one I need to lead, even if it's not the one I would have picked for myself. It's the right thing for me to do, and it's also the right thing for you to do. I had to accept that the world I knew was going to go away, and I needed to make changes in the way I lived my life in order to prepare for that. I even tried to leave the United States and get rid of my citizenship. I just wanted to run away. But there's no place to run to. At all. Even with my skill, there isn't a way out of the trouble that's coming. There's nowhere left to run and hide anymore. The only option left is to come home and help the party make sure the white race has a country to call our own where we can safely replenish our numbers away from our enemies. To be ready to confront our impending genocide, white individuals must successfully confront their own personal problems which keep them from contributing to the party's political efforts. I did a submission to RFN some weeks back about what happens when people don't deal with their problems, and it's very pertinent to step two. Tiny problems turn into major problems when you don't deal with them. Long-standing personal defects have a way of coming back to bite you when you least need them to, such as when you're starting to realize you actually have to listen to the advice the party gives you and come home, or else our race is going to perish from the earth in less than a century's time. So what's keeping you from coming home? There's not a future where you are, since eventually this entire continent is going to be one gigantic mud-colored mass. Further, perhaps you're about to lose a home for various reasons. If that's the case, you're moving anyway, aren't you? If you need work, I can vouch that at the very least the Puget Sound area is booming compared to the rest of the country right now. Are you lazy, shiftless, or otherwise unemployable? Well, you're going to have to work on that even if you weren't going to come home. But doing so is what will allow you to finally take a little responsibility and come join the party in our efforts. Even if you have a character defect that is keeping you from functioning no matter where you are, you're going to have to handle it in order to continue existing. It's been said before, but I'll say it again. Northwest migration is the solution to your problems because it forces you to overcome them for, at the very least, your own benefit. After last week's RFN, Mr. Covington had to remind me that white boys don't do too well with hard truth, no matter how it's presented. Without starting all that up again, the main thrust the party was trying to make is that system politics and the ballot box aren't going to fix our problems for us. Following the U.S. Constitution isn't going to fix our problems for us. Anything other than the Northwest Imperative is not the way forward. Being told this was apparently too hard for some people, so we were dissented on by those who couldn't handle it. These responses aren't motivated by serious political thought, but rather a desire to deliberately misunderstand and ignore something important, because these people haven't matured to the point where they can handle hard facts. If nothing else, step two is about becoming the sort of person that accepts very difficult and unpleasant reality with a view towards changing it. On a personal level, this means being willing to deal with things about yourself you know aren't right. Hail victory, comrades.
Okay, I think it's a little bit early in the month yet to be playing Halloween music, so this week I think we'll feature the music of one of the most talented banjo pickers, singers, and performers of the 1960s folk revival, a fellow named Walter Forbes, who inspired me to learn to play the banjo at the age of 13.
I know.
As I sit here speaking to you, there is a man sitting in prison in Roanoke, Virginia, named William A. White. Those of you who follow my Thought Crime blog and the Northwest Observer will be aware of who Bill White is, and you'll have some idea of what his present situation is. For those of you who do not, Bill White goes on trial on October the 31st for the hideous and unspeakable crime of sending his wife an irate and angry email during their divorce over a money issue. For this, he is looking at a possible sentence of 20 years in prison. The reason that this is happening is because in Bill White's case, the American dictatorship, acting through its servants in the Justice Department and the United States Attorney's Office, has changed the legal definition of what is a quote-unquote credible threat away from the former objective assessment of what the law referred to as a reasonable man, in other words, what a reasonable man would have inferred to be a threat, to whether or not the words or behavior of the accused, quote-unquote, caused someone to feel apprehension or fear for their life. In other words, basically right now, anyone, including some Jew or feminist or weirdo listening to these words of mine on Radio Free Northwest, can go running to a United States attorney claiming that my words, my presence on the air, my very existence, causes them to feel apprehension, and that, under the law, is now defined as uttering a threat, or being a threat, or communicating a threat, or making a terroristic threat, or whatever the hell. The next step, of course, is to charge whatever white boy is accused of causing this apprehension, and get them up in front of a jury full of niggers. This is what is going to happen to Bill White on October 31st. Beyond that, I won't comment on Bill's case because I don't want to be accused of somehow messing it up, but I do believe that it is my duty to make sure that Bill White is not silenced by the dictatorship. Accordingly, I'm printing his essays that he writes in prison, both in Northwest Observer and on my blog. And although audio footage of Bill is rare, one of our guys was able to find some. This is from the year 2008, April 2008. A Hitler's birthday celebration in Chicago for Bill's former National Socialist grouplet that he was the head of at the time. This is approximately 6 months before the dictator's servants came to take him away in October of 2008. You may or may not agree with Bill in this speech. I know that a lot of people are not Orthodox National Socialists. I still am. Bill apparently still is, even in jail. But just remember, this is a voice that Barack Hussein Obama and Eric Holder and the whole crew of our lords and masters do not wish you to hear. It is therefore incumbent upon us to hear it.
Our next speaker is Bill White, commander of the American National Socialist Workers Party.
Greetings, comrades. I'd like to thank Phil Anderson for stepping in at the last minute to do the introductions. Art Jones for having put this meeting together today. Tony Zirkle for coming all the way from Indiana and his congressional campaign to address us. Harry Junker for flying in from Washington, D.C. on a marathon of speeches to address us. And everyone who came out today, it is my honor to speak to you at this 119th birthday party for our leader, our Führer Adolf Hitler. This is my honor to serve many of you as commander of the American National Socialist Workers' Party. We have established ourselves in the past year as the leader of National Socialism in this country. No other organization has achieved what we have achieved. Leonard Pitts, the Gina Six, even Lima, Ohio, or the little actions we take every day, our detractors have said that we are only a small group of activists. But I say we are the most effective small group of activists in the United States today. We have shown that a handful of people with will and determination can achieve what thousands hiding behind an internet forum cannot. We have cast aside the fear and the paranoia that has characterized the white movement for too long. No longer do we hide in fear of the Jews. The Jews hide in fear of us. And how they do. I sat in a courtroom 2 weeks ago with a Department of Justice related official who was demanding I be censured for contempt. He took a stand crying and trembling. He said I mentioned his name on my website, and so he had to hire two bodyguards, rewire his house with an alarm system, and send his wife to another city. He also wanted me to pay for it. Fortunately, I haven't had to yet.
Lively money.
As our attorney noted, we stir up the hates. We get these people caught up. They're so afraid. They know that what they're doing is evil. And when we confront them, they get so afraid they're going to be held accountable for their evil. They just flip out at the mention that we may come after them. No other white organization has had Jesse Jackson go to the president to demand that it be banned, or had Al Sharpton demand congressional hearings into its activities. But in our fight, we must not forget. We must not lose sight of our objectives. Our objective is not the subjugation of the Negro. Our objective, primarily, is not the extermination of the Jew. We fight, and our objective is to fight for the future of the white working class. We fight these Negro and these Jew agitators because they threaten that white working class. And on our struggle for the white working class, we must focus on the real economic, cultural, social conditions that white workers are facing today. We are in a time of economic collapse, what you might call a crisis of capitalism. This is not the future. This is not a prediction. This is not a, I don't have to pay taxes, militia theory. We are in a situation where we are seeing deflation and inflation affecting our economy at the same time. There's a deflation in the credit market. Those assets that have to be bought on credit are collapsing because credit has been restricted. But there is massive inflation in the cash market. Those consumer goods that are paid for out of the wages of working people are going up in value. This is the situation we saw just prior to the Great Depression of the late 20s and 1930s. And it means three things. It means that we are going to see massive losses of jobs as businesses, particularly small businesses, which employ over half of our workforce, are unable to get the credit and the capital they need to produce jobs for workers. We are going to see a middle class impoverished. Much of the middle class in this country is dependent upon their home and their car and their major assets for their value. Well, they can no longer borrow money against it. Those assets are deflating, and the real living conditions of the middle class will deteriorate accordingly. Third, for working people, we already have the situation where people can't purchase gas for long trips. They can't afford it. I was shocked coming here to Chicago to see it pushing into the upper $3. It's still under $3 down in Roanoke, Virginia. But this is combined with the rise in food prices. We've already seen internationally 33 countries destabilized by food riots just in the past few weeks. These are countries poorer than our poorest. But these food prices are continuing to rise, and the bottom of our society is going to run out of or be very limited in their ability to acquire basic staples, gasoline, food, clothing, housing. This is what happened in the Depression. It happened in Germany, not just in the United States. They actually destabilized the German economy after the war, came up with something called the Rentenmark that they based on a system of mortgaging all the real assets in the country. Germany had been deindustrialized. Factories had been packed up and shipped overseas. The industrial heartland had been turned over to the French. And so the only thing they had left was to mortgage their real estate, and they built a currency based on that mortgage of the real estate, and that system failed just prior to our ascension to power. Similarly, in the United States, we have built an economic system based on mortgages. And we've deindustrialized and shipped our factories voluntarily overseas. We didn't have to be defeated in a war. We just packed them up and sent them off. And we put in a system of credit and an economy and a currency based upon the mortgaging of our real assets. We are seeing today a very similar failure of that system. I hope we see after it our ascension to power. Ask how we got here. Liberals, conservatives, Republicans, Democrats, who's more responsible? There's no more responsible. They're all responsible.
Right.
They're all responsible because they all share one thing in common. Internationalism. And that internationalism is nothing but a code word for the Jews. We look at the modern crisis in credit, the modern deterioration of the currency. We see it starting in the Nixon administration when the U.S. was taken internationally off the gold standard. And we see the conservative hero, Ronald Reagan, step by step opening up the borders to this internationalist doctrine, raising the interest rates, allowing them to float, opening the borders to immigrants, granting amnesty to immigrants, opening the borders to China, India, Pakistan, Taiwan, Japan, Bangladesh, granting most favored nation status. We saw the bankruptcy of farmers, the forcing of agriculture into these large conglomerates in the late 80s, and we see him paving the way for Bill Clinton, who brought us NAFTA, brought us the Central American amnesty, continued the globalist, internationalist, free trade, open borders policies, and then got a crackdown on militias and constitutionalism that made some confused white workers think electing a Republican, George Bush, would be the answer. The results? Real wages for American workers peaked in 1974. Manufacturing jobs are gone, and they've been replaced. These $24 an hour, or, you know, $30 an hour factory jobs are now $6 an hour or $8 an hour service jobs. They took working people from production to servitude. In Roanoke, Virginia, they do it consciously. Where I come from, the mayor has put forward a program. The railroad left, factories left. So he's going to take the working people who used to work for the railroad or the factories and make them all hairdressers and taxi drivers for the rich Jew tourists he's going to bring down from New York and New Jersey. And this is happening all over the country. We imported this little editor from Oregon who told us that we have to turn to tourism because industry in America is dead. And the real wages for white workers have continued to fall because many of the high-paying technical jobs that have been created in this country have gone to H-1B foreigners. They put white working people out of factories, they put white working people out of high-paying, organized labor jobs, and they put them into servitude, and then they bring in foreigners to fill the ranks of the newer, higher-paying jobs they're creating. So if we were to talk about the wages of white workers in real terms, all workers are falling, but white workers have collapsed. And with the deterioration of the employment of white workers, we've seen a deterioration in living standards, a deterioration of white families, deterioration of white neighborhoods, a deterioration of white people, and a deterioration of white identity. We've also seen an integration in this country, not a happy, shiny, multiracial, multicultural integration, but an integration forced by poverty and based on mutual poverty. And this integration has brought not the joys of diversity, but Negro crime, Negro drugs, and Negro prostitution into disadvantaged white communities. And it has always been the plot of the Jew to attack the most vulnerable elements of our people through this form of integration.
Okay, one of the things that was suggested in many of your responses to my recent poll on what you guys wanted to hear on Radio Free Northwest was that I once again should start podcasting such audio fragments as can be found from our movement's past to introduce you younger and newer listeners out there to the fact that we have a past, which we do, of course, just nobody knows about it. Now, one of our guys was able to locate a short clip from a speech which, judging from internal evidence, was given to some kind of rally or meeting in the late 1970s or early 80s by the late Jesse B. Stoner of the National States Rights Party, whom I knew personally. Now, some of you may remember J.B., and if you don't, you missed something. J.B. was a real trip. He was one of these old-line segregationist types that for 30 years kept the white resistance movement going, especially in the South, but all over the country, really. I think at one point in the past, several years ago, I told a few J.B. Stoner jokes on here, on his show. The only one I can remember right now, and maybe some of you remember it as well, but I'll tell it again. J.B. was running for lieutenant governor of Georgia in 1970-something or other. And there was an Atlanta TV station, very liberal, of course, that was offering free airtime, 5 minutes each, to all the statewide candidates to, you know, state their positions, blah, blah, blah. And so JB, being a registered candidate in the Democratic primary, see, in those days, the Democrats were still the party of white supremacy in Georgia, at least in people's minds. Anyway, JB shows up at the station, and the station manager takes him aside and says, "Well, Mr. Stoner, look, we know that you have some very outspoken views, and this is going to be a live broadcast, and we're going to have to ask you to moderate your language on the air." JB says, "Well, what do you mean, moderate my language?" And the station manager says, "Well, you know, there's certain words that we don't like to broadcast on the air here, you know, one beginning with N." And JB says, "Oh, okay, yeah, I know. Okay, fine, look, that's all right. I can be civil here. Don't have to worry." And so the station manager was reassured. And so the program went on the air, and all the candidates got up, and they had their 5 minutes, you know, talking about whatever they were talking about. And so JB's turn comes, and he gets up on there, and he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Jesse B. Stoner from Atlanta, Georgia. I am a candidate for the lieutenant governor on the Democratic primary ticket in this election, and I just got one thing I want to say. Nigger, 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 nigger." Anyway, now you can hear JB for yourself.
"I thank you, Mr. Lewis Beam, but after hearing that introduction, I'm looking for another speaker up here." "I've been fighting Jews and niggers all of my life. Now, I quote from the Bible. I believe in the Bible. I worship my Lord Jesus Christ, but I'm not a preacher. God didn't call me to be a preacher. God called me to fight Jews and niggers. And so I engage in that fight against the Jews and niggers because that is the best way to serve and glorify God and to help the white race. This struggle has been going on, of course. I guess the struggle between good and evil has been going on ever since the time of Adam and Eve. And the fight's not over yet. I don't want to neglect to do my part. And you don't want to neglect to do your part to keep the side of righteousness going strong. Now, I know when it came to race mixing in the schools, I opposed that very strongly starting in 1954 when the U.S. Supreme Court said that segregation in the schools is unconstitutional and illegal, and so they had to integrate. The federal government, Federal Bureau of Integration and the so-called Justice Department were so afraid that the white people in the South would rise up against them. They were so afraid of the people, of the white people I'm talking about, they really had no reason to be afraid of them. They were too gutless. But they were so afraid that when it came to integrating the public schools in the South, they only integrated one school in one state at a time. They were that much in fear of the white people. They were prepared to back down on school integration if the white people had stood up for their rights. I've picketed, along with others, public schools when they first started integrating. We would talk to the parents. We'd say, "Well, how about keeping your children out of school in protest for a week or a few days to show that you're not going to put up with school integration?" And most of them would, in effect, say, "Well, my little Johnny, he can't afford to miss one day of school. It doesn't make any difference if education is destroyed. My little Johnny, he must be..." So I say, "Their little Johnny must be real stupid if he can't lose a few days or a week out of school to protest school integration." When they first integrated in Georgia in one school, in one county, we tried to get white people all over the state to boycott. But no, they wouldn't do it. They say, "Well, that's not my school." Ralph McGill, that communist editor of the Atlanta Constitution, was notoriously against the white race and wanted to destroy it. Back at that time, he would write that the niggers and the NAACP and all didn't want to mix up with the whites, they didn't want to date whites, they didn't want to marry whites, and he would ridicule the statement that some people would make to nigger lovers. People sometimes, when somebody was for integration, they'd say, "Well, would you want your daughter to marry a nigger?" And Ralph McGill and the other race mixers said back then, "That's ridiculous. Nobody wants to marry a nigger, and no nigger wants to marry a white, and no white wants to marry a nigger. That's not the nigger objective." In fact, Ralph McGill and his gang on the Atlanta newspapers went so far as to say that all the federal government wanted was a little token integration, and they would be satisfied. Well, now you can watch the news, you can watch TV talk shows and all, and they condemn anybody who is opposed to interracial dating. They condemn anybody who is opposed to interracial marriage. These race-mixing lunatics that promoted the race-mixing movement in this country have always been lying to the people. When it came to the fight over school segregation and integration, back before 1954, nobody had ever hardly heard the words segregation and integration. In the South and in other areas, including Washington, D.C., where they had segregation, they didn't call it that, they called it white supremacy. Ancient India is a good example of that. They had segregation reinforced by both religion and law, but since the whites and dark races stayed there together, they gradually intermingled and the white race there was polluted. That's what would happen here. If the nigger stayed here with segregation, with white supremacy or integration, the white race would be doomed because there are always some sorry whites that want to mix up with niggers. More and more insane white people are marrying niggers. I don't know how anybody would want to marry a nigger. I don't know how anybody could stand the odor. Of course, they use the educational system from kindergarten through college. They teach race mixing there. If somebody wants to get up in the academic world and become a famous professor, he has to go along with it. If teachers want to survive, they have to go along with race mixing insanity. If someone gets in the news business and gets up on a newspaper or an important place in television, he has to be a nigger lover and pro-Jew or he doesn't get up there. They don't have to tell him what to say. I was talking to an idiot one time and he said, it would be impossible to have a Jew looking over every newsman's shoulder. And so I told him, well, they don't have to. If you want to get up high in ABC, CBS, or NBC, you know you have to be pro-Jew and pro-nigger or you won't ever get up high there. If you're running for public office right now in most places in the United States and want to get elected, you have to take a stand against the white race. You have to, in effect, hate the white race. Otherwise, you're a bigot. You're a racist. You're a hater. It's interesting how the world's biggest haters are against hate. They have a monopoly on hate. The Jews have a monopoly on hate. It's impossible for a white man to hate like a Jew hates. Yet they're the ones that pass the laws against us white people and say anytime we're critical of a Jew, that is hate. You disagree with a Jew, it's hate, and you're politically, what's the word, politically incorrect. So they keep everybody... They're coming up with a propaganda machine, not an honest propaganda machine, but a lying propaganda machine, to try to define all the words in our language. They use the word hate as a propaganda word. They use racist as a propaganda word. Well, I'm a white racist, and I'm proud of it, and if enough other white people in America who are white racists in their heart would openly speak out, that would take much of the fear out of the white people and put it back into the Jews and niggers where it belongs. The white people didn't rally in the South enough to stop race mixing in the schools, which they could have done. In fact, those poor shanty Irish up there in South Boston put up more resistance against school integration than all the white people all over the South. Yet back in those days, if you talked to white people that didn't have children in school and some that did, they'd say, well, that won't ever happen here. They'd say, we've never had it, and so we never will. I've had people tell me that Supreme Court decision for race mixing in the schools would never be enforced, that we've always had segregation, always will. Well, we haven't always had school segregation. Back in the days of Reconstruction after the Civil War, or uncivil war, whatever you want to call it, whites often had to go to school with niggers. Not only that, but you had some of the church people bringing... Back at that time, during slavery, they brought niggers into church and put them in a balcony, and that went on even after slavery was done away with. It was outrageous. There's still old churches in the South where you can see those balconies. They're just wasting their time trying to convert a bunch of cannibals. And a nigger is not descended from Adam and Eve, and a nigger doesn't have enough brains to understand the gospel of Jesus Christ. That reminds me, I was a lawyer, but they disbarred me. I'm a disbarred lawyer, and I guess it's something to be proud of when you consider the reputation of the legal profession.
This is Walter Forbes.
station now, the mule's done run away. Abe Johnson had an old gray mule, his name was Simon Slick. Back his ears and lift his tail, how that mule would kick. Now the mule done run away. Let's hear the story about a boy and a gal friend backed up in the mountain. This is back in them days when they used to board on mules, don't you know? This old feller's mule done got loose in the hitch rack. He's a trying to get his mule and his gal friend together for all he's worth and can't do nothing with it. That fella sure got some troubles. I'm a mule, a mule, I holler. I tie a knot the old mule's tail just to hear him beller. Well, if I had a needle and thread fine as I could sew, I'd sew my sweetheart to my back and down the road I'd go. Oh, oh, mule, oh, oh, mule, I'll say, ain't got time to kiss you now, the mule done run away. Keep cool, keep your seat, everyone, I'm messing with my mule. I want you, oh, oh, mule, I say, ain't got time to kiss you now, the mule done run away.
Okay, one quick current events comment on something that happened over the past week. Specifically, when the D.C. cops shot that crazy negress who tried to ram a car through the White House gate because she thought Obama was recording her and broadcasting her life on reality TV, kind of like that Jim Carrey movie, The Truman Show. Hell, thanks to Edward Snowden, it looks like, for all we know, she may have been right. Apparently, this was just a case of some nutso Sheba off her meds, but it shows how incredibly paranoid our lords and masters are about anything that even remotely suggests direct action for change. They got an alarm that something had happened at the White House, and they went absolutely batshit, hustling those yay-saying leeches in Congress into bunkers and panic rooms and whatnot, and filling the Capitol Rotunda with snipers and black body armor, lest mysterious terrorists from beyond the moons of Jupiter try to actually change something or threaten the wealth and power of some pale asshole in a $5,000 suit. And then when the crazy Sheba was finally pulled over near the Capitol as the police chased her down Constitution Avenue, she got out of the car and apparently the cops didn't even try to arrest her. They just shot her down, which is what they did to that guy Evan Able, the one who allegedly whacked the Colorado prison commandant. When they caught him down in Texas, the local county Mounties just shot him down on the street. Now we're seeing a lot of that. Cops just shooting people down on the street and nothing being done about it. That, of course, gives other cops around the country the idea that they can get away with it, and of course they can. Look, legitimate governments don't react with this kind of crazed terror every time something goes pop. They know that they're hated, and they know that they're vulnerable, even if we don't, and our lords and masters are scared shitless to overreact like this at the slightest noise. Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown. Okay, a couple of questions on the Constitution on foot of my shortcast last Sunday. Now, guys, when you have these questions, could you do something for me? Could you email me directly at nwnet@earthlink.net and not leave complex questions on the comment section to the blogs, please? Now, the reason being is that sometimes when I'm trying to transfer your comment to the proper format and place, I forget to make a note of who sent it in. Anyway, some guy who is apparently one of these people who likes to parse little legalistic details asked me the following. Dear HAC, okay, on section 2, I haven't taken any political science courses, so I request some clarification on these. Question. Section 2, Article 4. Is there something called a citizenship roll that isn't in my vocabulary, or is that supposed to be roll, R-O-L-E? No, the citizenship roll is the roster or list of those in the Northwest Republic who have achieved first, second, and third class citizenship. It is the same as the voter's roll. If you're a citizen, i.e. if you've done your national service and you've earned the right to participate in elections and the political process, then you can vote either one or two or three times as the case may be. Which actually is exactly what the article you're asking about explains quite clearly. I'm not quite sure why the question here. Section 2, Article 16, what does constant session mean? Does that mean a handful of ne'er-do-wells could put through a bill at 2 a.m. on a Sunday while the rest of the convention sleeps? Okay, no, not constant 24-hour-a-day, 7-days-a-week session. It means that when the citizens elect deputies to the National Convention every 6 years to run the country, those deputies go to Olympia or Spokane or wherever it's determined that the legislature will sit, and they run the country. They do not meet for 3 weeks and then skive off for 2-month recess vacations like some parliaments and legislatures do. The convention's deputies will have many other functions other than just passing laws, because a lot of actual and direct power will be held by the committees. Now, I believe that where politicians are concerned, any politicians, the devil makes work for idle hands. And every elected people's deputy needs to be kept busy from morning to noon to night on the business of the Republic. For example, the Constitutional Committee will fulfill the role that the Supreme Court now holds in this society of determining whether something is constitutional. One of the great things about the NAR Constitution is that it completely eliminates the judicial branch of government. Also, convention deputies will be assigned various admin jobs for the government to bring them into the actual process of running the country, not just sitting on their butts making up rules and regulations for everybody else. Okay, back to the email. Section 2, various articles. Please define full session in regards to the convention. It means everybody in the convention, not just separate committees, or what I believe is called in parliamentary parlance a plenum, which means a section or part of the legislature supposedly authorized to deal with a specific issue. Full session means everybody. Okay, now this individual asks if I have quote-unquote supporting documents on the Constitution, which as it happens I do, sort of, if you count a lot of 8-year-old emails. Certain letters from prisoners have also been retained in a safe place, and with any luck, by the time that the people of the White Northwest actually decide that we want to do this and take the necessary steps to make it real, some of this stuff might even survive, and one day future generations can go to a museum and gawp at one of my thumb drives in a glass display case. Actually, I looked over what I did retain, and some of it's pretty interesting, but it's almost impossible to adequately present in this format. Now, I did find one document which I suppose I could read out to you, but I hate just sitting here and reading things aloud to you guys, stuff that really was intended to be read and not spoken, and that applies to a lot of my own work as well, by the way. But, okay, I'll give it a shot. And before I get into this, no, I'm not going to publish all this stuff and reopen the idea of the Constitutional Convention or something like some of you have been hinting, because I know why you want to do it. You want to waste another year or 2 years having email and computer discussions to give you that much more excuse not to get your pale asses up here. Where the hell are you supposed to be? This submission is from the man that many know as the Sage of Yakima, my old Rhodesian buddy, Eric Thompson, and it's laid out in outline form, so this is going to sound really stiff and stilted as I read it out. Okay. Proposed structure for an Aryan national state by Eric Thompson. Fundamental axioms. Oh, these are kind of like sections or headers he divided them into. Number 1, form follows function. Number 2, public good must come before private welfare. 3. The state is the vessel which protects the race. The race is the vessel which nurtures the individual. Number 4. No system is better than its members. 5. The nation can survive only through eternal vigilance on the part of an informed and active citizenry. Section 2, entitled Organization. 1. Okay, here's where we get into articles and subarticles and subsections and subheaders here. Let me figure out the best way to read this out here. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to eliminate a lot of the headers and subsections and all that sort of stuff. Okay, here goes. By the way, Eric uses the term National Congress rather than National Convention, which is what was later decided upon. Anyway, okay, here it goes. The National Congress is composed of all citizen voters. It governs by national referendum. A national referendum is the outcome of a national initiative process. Any citizen voter can sponsor a national initiative. The following branches of government are comprised of candidates elected by national initiative and referendum, any or all of whom are subject to recall at the behest of the citizen voters. Point 2. The national executive oversees enforcement of existing laws and may be instructed from time to time by a national referendum in regard to law and/or policy. Point 3. The national legislature enacts new laws or changes old laws subject to a national referendum. It regulates the money supply to prevent inflation or deflation of the currency. The money supply is indexed to the supply of goods and services, i.e. to economic productivity. This is the National Socialist Economic System invented by Hjalmar Schacht. The legislature manages foreign exchange to prevent currency speculation in the Aryan economy. It may be instructed from time to time by national referendum. The National Judiciary. Like the National Executive and the National Legislature, the National Judiciary is subordinate to the National Congress of Citizen Voters. The National Judiciary interprets law should disagreements occur. As I said, in the draft that we produced in 2006, we completely eliminated all political governmental functions of the judiciary. Under the 2006 Constitution, the court system exists purely to try matters of civil and criminal litigation and to determine fact. It has no constitutional or interpretative role at all. It enforces the law. It does not interpret it. There's another section entitled Citizenship. Citizenship can only be earned as a privilege after fulfillment of requirements as set forth in a Bill of Privileges and Obligations. And this is one of the things from Eric that we most definitely adopted, as you can see when you read the draft. Obligations would include racial purity, community and/or national service, obedience to laws. It would also include the individual's abilities, accomplishments, and character without regard to chronological age. Privileges would include reproduction and child rearing, legal economic activities for public good and personal gain, property holding, and voting. Subsection 2 here. Citizenship is revoked on criminal conviction. In non-capital offenses, a convict may redeem his citizenship by community service. Convicts who refuse community service will be euthanized. Convicts who commit additional offenses will be euthanized. All citizens and provisional citizens are deemed to be sane and are responsible for their actions as adults in regard to criminal offenses. So, no pleading insanity when you get caught burning somebody's house down or chopping somebody up with an axe. Provisional citizenship applies to children of citizen parents, includes obligations for the earning of citizenship through participation in community service groups and/or military defense forces, through acquisition of knowledge and skills in or out of the National Academy, not quite sure what that was, by passing National Academy tests which evaluate intelligence, knowledge, physical fitness, and character, also through generally recognized achievements. Children who refuse to earn citizenship credits or cannot do so for medical reasons cannot become citizens. Anyway, for about a year, we spent a lot of time wading through a lot of stuff like that from a lot of people. And you can see what we came up with when you go to northwestfront.org or open the back of your white books. This is Walter Forbes with a song from the 30 Years' War.
Pretty Peggy, oh, won't you marry me, pretty? country could be free, pretty Peggy, oh. Oh, I wouldn't marry you, sweet William, oh. I would marry you, sweet William, oh. I would marry you this fall, but your fortune's too small. Our country must be free, sweet William, oh. What would your mother think?
I saw an interesting article in Huffington Post the other day. They snuck a spy into some NRA meeting in Houston, and the spy noted and reported back that the speaker was complaining about all the gray and white heads in the audience. The conservatives, as well as we, are worried about the problem of their aging support base. Now, that's the really bad part about so-called demographic change. Not just that white babies are no longer being born in sufficient replacement numbers to prevent extinction, but that the majority of the white population are now baby boomers over 55 who are going to start dying off like flies before the end of this decade. Now, this is the greatest obstacle we have to overcome now. How to build a Northwest independence movement that doesn't look like a retirement community. Now, right now, white boys spend their youth dicking off in school. They live in their parents' basements for a few years, and then if they ever do get a job, for a while they just sort of snuffle around like pigs at the slop trough until they're about 42 or so. And then, when the trough runs dry, they look up and look around themselves and say, "My God, where the hell did my wonderful life that I was supposed to have go? I've been deceived and cheated and robbed of that wonderful life that America and Obama promised me. Who did this?" Sorry, people, but we can't rely on enough white males having a midlife crisis in their 40s to fill the ranks of the volunteers. We have to start getting to them young. Okay, now I'm sure that's more or less what happened to a lot of you guys who are listening to me right now, so you know all the reasons why it seems to take most of us white boys so damned long to learn wisdom. And let's face it, guys, if the money had kept on flowing and your wife hadn't been such a bitch and run off after picking your carcass clean, would you ever have learned wisdom at all? Or would you have never taken it beyond Rush Limbaugh? It's not that there are not millions of angry young white men and women out there who have realized that they're being screwed into the ground by political correctness. There most certainly are those millions of young white men and women. There are millions of these kids who have seen their lives turned to crap through foreclosure and unemployment and racist discrimination from the Democrats, and they are angrily searching for a solution. And they're not finding us, because no one knows that we are here. Not young people, not old people. You've all got these fantastic machines that will allow you to communicate with tens of thousands of people, more than that if you use them right. We have a great website and a great party manual and a great podcast, if I do say so myself. Can you really not make the connection in your minds here? Do you really need for me to hold your hand and walk you through this? Those young white people out there are searching for the Northwest Front. They need to start finding us. Get your asses in gear and do it. Our time is up, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.